cheerleaders for war. We talked this morning about some of the headwinds for the diplomatic settlement. We talked about some of the elements that we're looking for, a negotiated way out, people who understood that there is no military solution to this. But I mentioned this morning that we wanted to talk this afternoon specifically and focus on the other half of this inside the Trump administration. He's got a lot of headwinds. He's got one group of people inside his administration that are actively lobbying for diplomatic solution with the Iran war. But there's this other side that's putting enormous pressure inside and publicly on the outside, inside the United States, domestic news media especially. But one has to ask, what the question is, who is actually the biggest cheerleader for military strikes? Now, this was posted just hours ago on Truth Social by President Trump. And you see the first four panels there. You see apparently aboard Barack Obama. And he's allegedly saying, this is probably 2015, hey, let's negotiate to Iran. And then that's apparently supposed to be Iran there, and you can read what it says. Then it's, you see that Barack, Joe Biden, who also said, hey, let's negotiate. And then you see the same comment there back from allegedly the Iranian side. And then Trump adds another pair, and he says the same thing that the Iranians said on the other side, and then allegedly, let's negotiate. Now, President Trump has been adamant in so many times. In fact, if you saw some of my social media posts on X over the weekend, you saw that I put where he had this picture of a bomb that said, thank you for your attention to this matter. As he was saying, let's find a negotiated settlement, claiming that we had all but worked it out and everything was going to be announced soon. And then he posts this image of a bomb being dropped. So even he's given conflicting information. So if he's getting conflicting information and advice on the inside, he's also giving conflicting information on the outside as well. Who even knows where he's actually standing here? But it's unknown right now, and I'm sure this will all come out in due time, but it's unknown right now whether President Trump is influenced by all these people or if he is just unstable and just waffles back and forth between, we're looking for a diplomatic settlement, we're looking for a military solution. I don't know. But what is very clear is that these people probably don't know either. And those that are cheerleading for more war are just doubling down. I mean, like they're just hitting the full power on. Let's just drive harder, hit the gas to the floor. Yeah, there's the one, man. Thanks, Gary. Yeah. Who's actually the cheerleaders here? Seems like President Trump is almost like this split personality. One minute he's for diplomacy, and then the other minute, here goes the bombs. But let's take a look at those who are trying to exploit this, and what's trying to happen here. And let me just kind of set the stage. There has been at least two occasions in the last 2 weeks that I'm aware of where there apparently had been an order to start combat operations, and then they had to be unstarted, or they had to be ordered, had to be taken off right before execution. Trump admitted it in one case, and in the other case, some sources that I have said, yes, we were ready to go, we're on a knife's edge, and then told to stand down again. So that's at least two times that we were ready to go, and then he backed down. No one knows for sure why. These people who were on the inside, though, are like saying, okay, let's get him back up to this knife's edge again, and then let's see if we can push him over into it. And two of the biggest ones here, of course, as we show too many times, unfortunately, is Lindsey Graham and Jack Keane, and we have both of those to show very recently. Yesterday on Sunday television talk shows, you had Lindsey Graham leading the charge.
I think we hit a wall on deal-making. I would encourage the president to look at reducing Iran's military capability even further. They've been dramatically weakened, but there are still targets that could weaken them more militarily. I'm calling to hurt this regime. If you do the same old thing, you're going to get the same result. Hurt them more, maybe they'll make a deal if you hurt them enough. But right now, I think they're trying to wait us out. I think they're playing games. And in the words of the president, I think they're crazy.
Well, I mean, what could be better for a diplomatic solution than that? Call your people, your opponent, crazy. You saw Trump has said some version of that before. You saw Secretary of State Rubio have said that just in direct terms. Now here's a U.S. senator. I mean, why would it be hard to negotiate with someone when you're demonizing them across the board and then calling them also crazy? why would you have a negotiated settlement with someone that you think is crazy? And of course, that's the whole point. That's the subtext here. What these people are, like Lindsey Graham, are trying to do is to establish in the minds of the president, much less of the population, you can't make a deal with these people. They're crazy. Secretary Rubio seems to be in this camp. And by all accounts, he is definitely, weirdly, the Secretary of Defense. I'm sorry, Secretary of State is in the pro-war camp. You know, Secretary Hegseth is he's not seen a war he didn't love and wants to shoot more bombs and missiles every day. So that's accepted here. But you see that they're trying to put in your mind this idea that these people can't be reasoned with. They're just the, Kennedy from Louisiana, big proponent of this. They're religious Nazis, Lindsey Graham says. They want to kill everybody who's not like him, Senator Kennedy says all the time. So that, well, you have to come into your mind that, well, wow, if they're religious Nazis, if they can't be negotiated with, and if they all they want to do is kill us, and as soon as they get the bomb, they'll use it, my God, we can't have a negotiated settlement with these people. They may agree to it. And then, oh my gosh, they'll come after us when our guard is down. That's what they're trying to get into the mind, not just of the population, but of President Trump himself. And when he says stuff like he has said, and when he shows pictures like that, then they think, hey, this is going in a good direction. Now, there's no substance behind this. See, Lindsey Graham is saying, okay, well, if you do the same thing, you're going to get the same result. So tacitly, he says, okay, look, whatever happened in the first 40 days, I mean, that didn't knock them out. So we got to do something different. We'll go, I don't know, after some different targets here. I don't know, maybe he's thinking they'll use some additional weapons. I don't know what additional weapons we have. We've already used bunker busters. We've used JASSM, long-range cruise missiles. We've used the Tomahawk cruise missiles. We've used the ATACMS cruise, long-range missiles. We've used all kinds of stuff. We don't have any other big, like, secret missiles that we haven't used so far that, at scale, are going to be able to do anything different than the first time. So when he categorically says, well, you can't do the same thing you did the first time, so you got to do something different. Okay, fair enough. What? What is different? He doesn't say. He just says, we'll try this. I think that was actually a comment he made just then. We'll try this. We'll try something different. Come on. One thing to be a cheerleader for vengeance, and he says, we want to hurt people, because, you know, Lindsey Graham is the one that has frequently said, I love this. We're killing all the right people. So he just loves that. So he's excited about hurting people, about killing all the right people. But even if you're wicked and have no morals and no moral compunction about killing people left and right, innocents or otherwise, whatever, that's just how war works in his mind, you've at least got to say, can this work? Because if you say, I hate that person and or those people and I want to kill them, and so I've got these assets to try to get it done, but if I do, they're going to take this counteraction here, which will harm my interest and my country and kill my people and make our entire economy potentially rock back and forth and possibly even collapse. You would think if anyone, even bereft of morality, just out of self-preservation would say, okay, well, that's not really a good idea. I would like it to work this way, but all of our assets and all of our resources and we have here and all of their defensive capabilities and all of their defensive positions, their bunkers, their mountains, these missile cities, we just can't, it's just a bridge too far. We don't have the capacity to take all of those things out. So I guess we're just going to have to grit our teeth and I don't know, live to fight another day, see if what can happen later. That would be a bad idea, but less bad than this one. But it's okay. So that's Senator Lindsey Graham. He was, I think, a lawyer in the military. So he has military past. I think he was a full colonel at one point in the reserve. But apparently, he didn't spend too much time taking any studying about military affairs themselves, just on the legal codes, etc. So it's one thing for him. It's another thing if it's allegedly a retired four-star general who was the deputy chief of staff for the United States Army and is supposed to be the absolute expert in all things about what is and is not possible in military terms. But I'm going to show you a couple of different things from General Keane here. And in the first one, he's going to address what I have advocated should be the primary objective, which is the walk-away theory. You're going to see that apparently, I don't know from our show or from others, who I'm certainly not the only one advocating for it, but he seems to be really afraid that that's going to happen. So again, he has the ability to pick up the phone and talk to Trump, and now he's talking to him on Fox News, where he knows Trump watches, and he's going to talk to other people here. Watch what he says about the walkaway plan.
I think what their objective has been, one is to get the ceasefire to stop the war on the promise of a deal, and then two, to drag it out as much as possible to put as much political, economic pressure on the president. I think they're still about doing that now, as they're trying to negotiate through the Pakistanis with us, you know, that they're still interested in a deal. I don't believe it. I don't think they ever have been. I think it's mostly just about dragging this out so that the president at some point, because of that political economic pressure, just ends the campaign and says we then declares victory, as opposed to going back and finishing it.
Just declares victory. So, oh, yeah, that'd be a terrible idea. But here's the thing. If there's no valid plan to accomplish that objective, if you can't finish the job, if there's no military means to do so, then it is the height of insanity, stupidity, to say, let's go ahead and go back in and do that. Let's try again what didn't work the first time, knowing what's going to be coming back in our direction. And this thing that they're not looking for negotiated settlement, that's, of course, a lie, too. I think we showed you this morning, Gary, if you can play that one down there, it's called Supreme on the bottom. This is the military advisor to the Supreme Leader in Iran earlier today. And he's warning that if you go back to military operations, we're going to strike. But he, a military guy, is actually prioritizing diplomacy.
About negotiation, the Islamic Republic has put the least costly path before you. The Islamic Republic is telling you that if you continue the war, we will make the American people miserable and the American economy miserable. Iran is here for a fair negotiation with you.
Now, it's also important to point out, why are we in this? He says in there, Jack Keane says in his comment that, oh, well, you know, the Iranians, they don't want a negotiated settlement. All they want to do is just drag this out. Why are we here at all, General Keane? Why are we even in these negotiations, General Keane? Was it because they started a war and we're trying to end it? Or was it because we started a war and now we're trying to negotiate a way out of it because we couldn't win it on the battlefield? You might want to rethink that one. That's the reality. So the idea that they want to drag this out, which we started, is just absurd. They don't want to drag it out. They want to get the war over with. They didn't want to start it in the first place, and they had a great diplomatic offer that I honestly didn't think that we could get, and yet they offered it 2 days before President Trump threw it in the trash and started this war, and now he's trying to crawl his way out of it. And instead of recognizing reality, you have this four-star general who wants to get deeper in trouble. He wants to, instead of digging his way out of the hole or climbing up on a ladder, he wants to dig a hole deeper. And he didn't stop right there by just saying, hey, I'm afraid of the walkaway theory. I'm afraid Trump may get tired and walk away and actually do what Daniel Davis is suggesting on the Daniel Davis deep dive. He's like, no, you know what? We really do need to dig deeper in this hole.
I think we're going to go back and finish it. I think that's where we are because the president recognizes where the Iranians are. They're not going to make a substantive deal. And listen, it's during this almost 6 weeks, our intelligence on targeting has obviously improved. Not only that, we're flush with munitions to be able to accomplish the mission. So we had about 2 weeks left in the campaign, Stuart, when we stopped. You know, close to 30% of the targets still remain. We've got to finish that. That's reducing the weapons that they have, obviously, to include dismantling nuclear weapons kinetically. And also, it means dealing with the realities of their support for their proxies, making certain that that's not going to be there.
So he's, again, going back to the maximalist demands. I want everything. No nuclear program, no long-range missiles, proxies. He doesn't want any of that, even though we couldn't get any of it before. And then he just, I don't know if he's ignorant or if he's lying. Impossible to say what it is from this distance. But let me just point out. So, but number one, he's kind of like Lindsey Graham says, well, you can't go back and do the same thing or you're going to get the same result. He said it in a different way. So he says, you know what? But you know what? We have better targeting now and we're flush with bombs. Okay. A couple of quick points. Are you telling me that we were insufficient with targeting before, even though we hit 14,000 aim points? We somehow were not smart enough, but in less than 2 months, somehow that we're all kinds of better. Did you get some new technology, something you didn't have before? I mean, what are you going to be able to even credibly claim this different this time with targeting, with intelligence capabilities, whether that's with drones, surveillance drones, satellite imagery, human intelligence, whatever, all these kinds of things, stuff we get from the Mossad. Did something new that you didn't have the first time? The answer is no, of course not. You just better targeting. That what does that even mean? You were sloppy the first time and now you're not sloppy? I don't know. But it's not going to materially make any difference whatsoever. Second thing he says, we're flush with bombs. So what? What does that matter? What does it matter if you're flush with bombs? You were flush with bombs on February 28th. You flushed out 14,000 of these things or targets. I think it was more bombs than that, than missiles that were actually launched, drones and that kind of thing. So you did all that before. You had targeting before. Yeah, we're flush with bombs before, and you didn't get anything done. And then he makes this absurd, pathetic claim. Oh, well, you know what? I mean, we were 70% of the way there, and then we stopped. And now we need to go back and finish that other 30%. As though, basically, Iran was on life support, and all we had to do was punch down another, I don't know, 2-3 weeks, something like that, knock out those last 30 targets, which apparently our intelligence and targeting knew then. I don't know. He doesn't explain that discrepancy, but whatever. Let's go back and just finish the job. Are you trying to tell me, and do you expect people like us who pay any attention to believe that you were 70% of the way there and you just stopped? That the White House said, yeah, we got them on the ropes. We're just about to destroy them. And then we'll just walk in and take their oil. We'll open the Strait of Hormuz, whatever we want to do. And we just stopped. I mean, come on, man. We're not stupid. If you could have finished the job, then you would have done it. There's no way on God's earth that Trump, from a position of power, is going to take his foot off the gas. That's not who he is. He hates to take his foot off the gas. He wants to push it down to the floorboard. And if he recognized any weakness and any strength on his part, he's going to drive it until you're gone. That's just how he operates. So don't expect us to believe that. Well, then obviously, then if that isn't the truth, what you're saying isn't the truth, then we are back to how are you going to get a different outcome with the same basic level of targeting, with the same munitions against the same targets? That's what they don't want to talk about. Lindsey Graham just kind of said, well, let's try different. I don't know. Hit some different targets. I don't know. Hit the mountain from a different angle. Who knows what? But folks, when a missile hits a granite mountain, it don't matter what angle it hits. It don't matter what direction it comes from. It's going to have to go through so much rock that it just can't. It doesn't have that much penetration power. It doesn't happen. Many of these, as I've told you, were designed to survive a nuclear blast. So no conventional missile is going to get what a nuclear weapon can't get at. It's just self-evident. So if President Trump listens to these people, he is virtually guaranteeing that the statement of the Iranian general that I showed you just a second ago is going to do what he said. And they're going to hit all these targets that they've already said. Here we go. Water desalination plants, oil infrastructure, gas pipelines, gas kinds of capabilities, all kinds of things, electric power generations, everything in the world. They said that they're going to hit it all. They said they already got the targets. All they got to do, the minute that the bombs start falling on them, they're going to hit their flip switch and start taking it out. And if Jack Keane, Lindsey Graham, Mike Pompeo, General Kellogg, Victoria Coates, Rebecca Heinrichs, all kinds of folks have just been on the airways begging Trump to go and do something that is near suicidal for our economy, that militarily won't work. We have proven that it won't work. Iran has proven that it can sustain these strikes because they would get hurt again. There's no doubt about that, by the way. If we go back and do the same thing, we'll blow up a lot more stuff and kill a lot more people. But the things that matter for the war, you're not going to blow up a mountain. You're not going to blow up speedboats and other kind of underwater torpedoes that you can't even see. You don't even know where they are. And you're not going to destroy these missile cities. You're not going to get rid of their proxy support. All of those things, that's the headwind here. That's what President Trump is fighting on the inside. So even though there's those talking on the you know, like the J.D. Vance wing and all those who are his allies on the inside are trying to talk common sense and ration to the president so that we get an America First outcome, so that we don't harm ourselves, President Trump just keeps vacillating back and forth and getting right up to the edge of military power. And one wonders, how many times can he get right up to the knife's edge and then roll back again? Or is the case, because apparently, according to some news that has been out over the weekend, also in the New York Times and elsewhere, is that Vice President Vance is on the outs with President Trump. If he could fire him, he apparently would, is what one of the publications said. So that means that he's having less and less influence. So if it gets back to the knife edge, he may not be able to walk him back the next time. That's just speculation. I don't have any knowledge about how that's working on the inside, only what I can piece together from the outside. And it ain't worked too good so far, except that it has kept it from going back in. Didn't keep us from going in the first time, but it apparently has worked a couple of times to back us off the edge. It's just unknown how many times it's going to happen. That's not the only edge that we have to worry about, though, because there's also the edge of the Israeli side. So Benjamin Netanyahu, there's definitely not a monolith here. He's got his own problems. Now, one of the key things for the any kind of a possibility of having a negotiated end is the issue of Lebanon, because Iran has said, and I think I showed you this morning in one of their statements that was on X, that they listed the things that they're trying to get done in level one, phase one of negotiated settlement. All the nuclear stuff would be phase two from their perspective. But the very first point in phase one was Lebanon. Is that there has to be a ceasefire on all fronts, which specifically includes Lebanon, and that means Hezbollah. And you know that was the deal in April that was a big bone of contention that Israel tried to sabotage several times by going back to war, and then they sort of backed off of it a little bit. I think they said basically Beirut would be off limits, but you know, defensive fires in the southern part after they've invaded southern Lebanon and having an actual ground war against Hezbollah, from which they're fighting back, and they always call that self-defense. But somehow that's been low enough beneath the radar that President Trump hasn't bothered with it. But it's not beneath the radar of the Iranian side. In fact, the Iranian side has said – oh, wrong one, sorry. The Iranian side has said very clearly that is a big deal. The Islamic regime, this is according to the Jerusalem – it was in the Jerusalem Post, but according to Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi from Iran – that the Islamic regime will not abandon Hezbollah. And so he's saying, yeah, that's non-negotiable. So if we're looking to have a negotiated settlement, it's going to have to include Lebanon, which means Israel is going to have to stop fighting. And of course, they don't want to do that. Well, it's a lot more than that. So Netanyahu's got some real problems. And in several reports I've seen today, and you know, a lot of these have been simmering for a long time, even before 10-7-2023. He was in all kinds of legal hot water and was at risk of corruption charges and a bunch of other charges against him that could literally put him in jail, even as a prime minister and sometimes former prime minister, maybe even in the future, could land him physically in prison, which is amazing thing to consider about in these days. But apparently that's still a big concern of his. And if this war ends, then he's going to be back on the docket again. A lot of the times he's supposed to have been in court, but he keeps pushing it off saying, oh, well, you got these contingencies and these emergencies and we can't go to the prison here. So or we can't go to the trial. So we have to postpone that for another day. Well, if there's a ceasefire there, if there's a ceasefire in Iran, if there's no active fighting anywhere, yeah, then he can go back to trial. And that's what he doesn't want. So he's worried about that on the one hand. And then he's also worried about, because there's some in the Israeli media this morning, in the English press media, they said he is at least reportedly concerned because he has less influence over Trump than he had before. And so President Trump, if he wants something, he's going to get it. Or if he doesn't want something, Israel is not going to get it, i.e. the Lebanon issue. So he has some concern about that. Well, inside of his own inner circle, just like President Trump, he's got some who want a negotiated settlement to get this off the table, and some others who very much don't want it to be over, and they don't want to let the foot off the gas in Lebanon. For example, Here is Bezalel Smotrich, Israeli finance minister, who on Monday called on President Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, to resume bombing, specifically in Beirut, in response to the increased explosive drone attacks by Hezbollah on Israeli troops in northern Israeli towns and in southern Lebanon. The explosive drones harming our fighters are not a decree of fate, he said in a statement. For every explosive drone, 10 buildings should fall in Beirut. So he's talking about mass punishment of civilian population. He's saying, okay, sure, we invaded into southern Lebanon and we were wiping out entire villages, literally razing them to the ground, just like in Gaza. And we're trying to carve out this against any international law, any law that there is, because they were not attacked, even though there's been fighting, firing back and forth between with rocket fire and other kinds of things. But Lebanon and Hezbollah certainly didn't attack into Israel, but Israel did attack into there, and they have literally been wiping everything physically off the map as they move into zone. So naturally, if you attack somebody, you're going to be in a war. They're going to fight back. Well, he's saying, basically, Smotrich, how dare Hezbollah fight back? They should just let us wipe them out and move them back and do nothing. But if they fight back, and if they use these FPV drones like the Russians and Ukraine use on each other, well, then for every drone we get hit, we should just destroy 10 buildings, civilian buildings, of people who have nothing to do with the fighting here and probably don't even like Hezbollah, but whatever, don't really care. Let's go and kill them up there. That is one person. Of course, he's a member of the cabinet. He's pushing Netanyahu to go that way, which would, of course, sabotage any possibility for a negotiated settlement for Trump in Iran. Well, it's not even just Smotrich, because he's a well-known person for that, but there's also one of the IDF chiefs. IDF Chief of Staff General Ayel Zamir said that Israel should attack Beirut in response to Hezbollah's drone attacks on Israeli troops in southern Lebanon during a security cabinet meeting on Monday. That's again today, according to sources confirmed by the Jerusalem Post. So it's not even just what he's saying, or what Smotrich is saying. Even the IDF is saying that, the IDF chief. So how then is Netanyahu going to say, if President Trump says, okay, I need you to take the foot off the gas, put the brake on in Lebanon, and stop fighting Hezbollah. Just stop fighting them, not in Beirut, not in southern Lebanon, foot off the gas, full brake. I don't know if he would ask him to withdraw or just, you know, stay in place and don't fight anymore, probably the latter. But you see, Netanyahu's under tremendous pressure not to do that. But he could come under tremendous pressure from Trump to do exactly that. And the question is going to be, how is he going to give in to that? Because everything in Iran could depend on what happens in Lebanon or in Beirut, either one of those. And listen, Israel is also concerned about some other things, because time is not on their side. They can't just keep dragging things out. This is from the Times of Israel today. Intel reports said indicate that Iran is rebuilding missile production faster than expected. We've showed just several reports in the American press here of late that shows that less was destroyed than we thought, like up to 70% survived, and that they continued to build. But not only did they produce or fix their facility so that 30 of the 33 missile factories, allegedly the ones that are on the Iranian coast, are fully operational again, have been fixed. Well, apparently, even within those missile factories, they're producing even more. According to the reports, Tehran has restarted manufacturing using surviving components, improvised underground facilities, and partially restored production lines with assistance from Russia and China. The report says Israeli defense officials now assess Iran could rebuild its drone capabilities within months and significantly ramp up ballistic missile production within about a year, possibly sooner. And that's, of course, on top of what we're already saying was survived from the first time. So they still have a significant inventory of both drones and missiles. And depending on who you want to listen to, apparently those inventories are quite large or moderately so. But whatever the real number is, and we'll only know in history or in the future sometime when they're looking backwards. But whatever that number is still substantial. And now here the Israeli press is saying, and you can never know whether they're saying this in order to put pressure on the idea to go back, or if they're actually being honest and saying, no, here's the truth, so we shouldn't go back. We'll have to wait and see how that works out too. But anyway, that's what is being reported in public by the Israeli press, that their intelligence says that the Iranian side is as smart as what we've known they always are. That's something that Iran has been known for, that despite all the sanctions, despite all these assassinations that have done, all these cyber attacks that have been done against their facilities, they always find a way to work around it and continue to have this arsenal. And now it was continuing to grow before this. And even after the bombing, they're now accelerating their ability because they're smart and they figured a bunch of stuff out. So that reinforces my argument in the walk away. Don't do the bombs away, do the walk away, because that's the only thing that's logical and makes sense. Do not dig deeper and make yourself in more trouble. I just can't highlight this enough, that the damage that would be done to our side if we foolishly listen to men like General Keane, Lindsey Graham, Mike Pompeo, Mark Levin, all these guys, if we listen to, if President Trump listens to those guys, it is going to be catastrophic for us. Let's hope he doesn't do it. All right, listen, I want to shift over to another topic here, because it's actually quite important, and that is what's going on in the Russia-Ukraine war. Now, as you may have seen here in the recent past, over the weekend, in fact, there were significant attacks by Russia into Kyiv itself. There have been, I think, at least two straight days of Oreshnik missiles that were seen hitting targets. Gary, if you have any of those B-rolls that we had this morning, that would be great, because there's some really stunning video coming out of the out of Kyiv here. And that apparently is just a taste of what is to come, because there has been some reporting out today, just within the last couple of hours. Russia warns strike on decision-making centers in Ukraine. And the armed forces are, according to the article here, this is Russian media, RIA Novosti, the armed forces are starting to strike at military industrial complex enterprises in Kyiv, including specific places for design, production, programming, and preparation for the use of UAVs by Kyiv regime, with the assistance of NATO specialists responsible for the supply of components. The provision of intelligence and targeting, they will be applied both to decision-making centers and command posts, the Russian department warned. All these facilities are located in the Ukrainian capital, so ministry urged diplomats and representatives in international organizations to leave the city as soon as possible, and local residents not to approach military and administrative infrastructure. Now, listen, President Putin has been coming under increasing pressure inside of Russia here of late, because he has not been able to even get the so-called special military operations, the SMO objectives of getting all of the Donbass, and now four rolling into 5 years. And so he's been coming under a lot of pressure. Why haven't you been doing this? And one of the things, one of the criticisms that he had been coming under was, why have you left the gloves off on all of these key areas in Kyiv? If that's where the command centers are, if that's where the production centers are, why have you left those off the target list? Because they're all used up here. They can complain about what happens from NATO and these 50 nations that support them, et cetera, but they're going to say, look, at the very least, this is a military conflict. Yeah, there's some of them there. Just amazing, amazing shots. These are coming from the capital city, and I think if we're going to get here in a second, there's some pretty dramatic shots of the missiles coming in the nighttime. But they're saying, look, let this be the beginning of something, not the end of something, because we need to continue doing this. Otherwise, we have no chance to win the war. And on the way, just here in the last few days, there's been a number of articles in the open Russian press debating this war. Oftentimes we say, oh, well, there's no freedom of speech or anything on the Russian side, but it turns out that actually there are. It's limited, because if you go too far, you can get yourself and thrown in jail, and many have. But this, for example, this morning I read on one of their military review, I think it's the Military Review on the Russian language, which is translated by Google Translate. There have been discussions on the pros and cons of continuing this special military operations or stopping it. And a lot of the discussion is, hey, look, because the Ukraine side just continues to find, whether it's stealing them off the street or not, whether it's mobilization or not, they find men to keep putting them in there up on the front. So no matter how many we kill, there's always somebody to replace them. And so we're not destroying the military. It's just kind of turning. Every time you kill somebody, another one comes up, but the military stays relatively stable. The front lines don't move very much because of the drones especially. That was the other thing that these it's an open press, open discussion, is that Ukraine has advanced a lot in drone capabilities. They've advanced in the ability to hit behind the Russian lines more effectively than before, because they continue doing research and development and coming up with capabilities that just didn't exist even 6 months ago in some cases. And Russia hasn't found a bypass for some of these. We've shown you, of course, some of the long-range shots that have been happening deep inside Russia. But even in the operational rear areas, in the supply zones have been hit. And so a lot of these analysts on the Russian side are saying, look, there's no prospect that this is going to be over for the foreseeable future, a year, 2 years. And there's no even projected end date there. And so we don't do ourselves any favor. It's not helping us to continue fighting a special military operation as opposed to a full mobilized war if we're not going to succeed. And so there's apparently a group within Russia that's saying, we just need to just get the war knocked out, get it over with. And they didn't say, at least these analysts didn't say what the terms would be on that, but they said it's pointless to keep fighting something we can't win, and we don't have the resources and the time to be able to win at a low cost. And of course, there's other analysts that have the opposite opinion. They say, no, we definitely can, and we should continue to press forward. We should press harder. And one wonders if that's part of what's starting to happen here, in that they're now starting to hit these facilities. This is the first time, first time they've been hit at all. There's been some drones and some other stuff that have been hitting targets in Kiev for a long time. But of the important things and the decision-making centers and of the leaders, those have been off target or off limits. But now apparently they're on. And this latest address here today by the Russian ministry saying, hey, foreigners, diplomats, y'all need to get out of Kiev, and definitely residents stay away from these military facilities or decision-making centers, because we're coming after them. So presumably when the sun goes down tonight, probably on tomorrow's show, we'll have more video to show you on that, but it could be quite substantial. Ukraine as also, oh yeah, that's what some of the ones right there. Those are some of the really dramatic ones from last night. And that's apparently a lot more than that is coming tonight, but you see that there's nothing you can do to stop that. I mean, whatever air defenses that Ukraine has, they were literally helpless to this. So if Russia decides that that's what they're going to do, you can see the one of the missiles flying through the air here. One of the other ones, you can actually see it traveling to the ground, and nothing's intercepting it. In fact, even that one there, you don't see any interceptor missiles even going up. They're just, this is Kiev, for crying out loud. This is not just some city. This is Kiev. And so if they're that vulnerable to Russian missiles in the city, you can imagine what they are elsewhere in the front lines. So Russia has very much control of the skies. It's not domination. They still have some limitations, but some. And then you see, in terms of what the missiles are, Russia has definitely the dominance right now. So they can make good on this if they decide they're going to hit some important decision-making centers, some important missile concerns, or other factories. They're going to hit them because you've got literally nothing to stop them. Meanwhile, the Ukraine side is in some sense looking to expand this. Now, we showed you last week, whether it was Karaganov or a couple of other well-known Russian folks who were saying, hey, we need to escalate into Europe, and we need to hit the same kind of targets that they're hitting in Kiev. We need to hit them in their cities, where their missile factories and their drone factories, and some of the other places where they have supply hubs, whatever, things that are funneling lethal military capabilities into Ukraine. We need to hit them over there. Well, turns out that it's not just the Russians who were thinking about expanding, but even Zelensky is reported to. There have been increasing numbers of Ukrainian troops move south of Belarus. Now, you may think, Belarus, why there? At least from what I've seen, there's not been any reported massing of Russian troops in Belarus like there was when the war started in February 2022, but Ukraine's moving them up there, and there are some suggestions that he may be hoping that Belarus enters the war and that they can then fight a battle there so that he can look back over here to NATO and say, I got to have, now it's another country against us and we're fighting this two-front war and we can't do it and we need you to come physically help us. I don't know if he would do that or not, but you sure know he would love to. He's been trying to get that since the war started 4.5 years ago nearly. So if he's trying to do that, that's something we need to keep a watch on. Meanwhile, we have Putin himself just made this interesting law, or signed into law today, this law authorizing the use of military forces to, quote, protect Russian citizens abroad. According to this report, Russian President Vladimir Putin signed on May 25th a bill effectively authorizing him to invade foreign countries under the guise of protection of Russian citizens. The legislation passed by the Russian State Duma on May 13th enables Russian president to order troop deployments abroad to protect Russian citizens facing arrest, detention, trial, or other perceived persecution by foreign nations and international courts. And one has to wonder, why now? What? Why are you passing that law right now? Because you may recall, in the lead up to this war that started in February 2022, there were a flurry of laws that were passed where Russia was able to go help the Donbas with their actual military. They had some agreements with the provinces of Donetsk and Luhansk, you know, to help them out. And then they authorized or recognized their independence, and then they ended up absorbing them into the Russian Federation. So there have been times when the laws were changed in Russia right before they needed to be able to cross borders, et cetera. So one, again, wonders if this, I mean, we're talking about a second ago, the pressures inside the American administration with President Trump, some wanting a diplomatic means, some wanting to go more military. You saw in Israel, same situation here. Same thing is going on. We talked about that this morning inside of Iran, where there's a hawkish side and a diplomatic side that wants to feature that. Same thing over on the Russian side, except that the side of more hawkish is starting to gain some ascendancy because they've tried it to use the small. The when they say the special military operation, that's not just a euphemism to try to make war not sound bad. It actually has legal ramifications in Russia. If they call it a war, that means different things, and that allows different target sets, that allows the government to do additional things, it allows them to force mobilize, it allows them to force economy to transition into a wartime situation where they don't have a choice, they are told what to do, they change what they produce, etc. So it is a major milestone if they go into a war. And so if they go from a special military operation to that, it implies a much bigger level of operation. So one has to wonder is, are those advocating for that in the Russian side starting to gain ascendancy? Why did President Putin make that law now, making it authorized for the military to go abroad? Because before they didn't have it. If they were not physically attacked by another country, according to the Russian law, they could not go abroad. And of course, who might be the first target of that but the Baltics in the north? That's one thing if you're launching military long-range missiles in France, Germany, UK even. That's been on the target. That's one of the things that Karaganov suggested, for example. But if you're talking the Baltic areas, on the other hand, that might be a more conventional military situation, because here just recently, the Western side and many of the Baltic countries have been openly saying we should take Kaliningrad, which is a Russian enclave that's physically separated from Russia, which has been there since the fall of the Soviet Union. It was negotiated, et cetera. But it's kind of a forward missile base. It's an odd situation here. But there are a lot in the West, even in their last few days, have been saying, man, that's like an eyesore. We should just go get it. You should just run out there and grab it. And so Russia here is hearing all this, and they're saying, you do that, maybe we should go grab this. And of course, there's a sizable Russian population in the ethnic Russian population in the Baltic countries. And so Putin signing this document now could be laying the foundation that, hey, if we start doing some things here, we may take this. And listen, the entirety of the Balkans, all three of those countries, the three Baltic countries, I think their total military ground forces is like a brigade, a combat brigade, reinforced brigade, something like that. It's not even a division level, all of them combined. So if Russia wanted to do something, it would be taking candy from a baby. I mean, they don't have defensive positions. They don't have the industry. They don't have anything except Article 5. That's one of the things they're clinging on to. Well, if that's what they're clinging on to while they're allowing their airspace to be used reportedly by Ukraine to get into Russian airspace to hit strikes deep inside their country, then Russia's saying you're already involved now. And they have been saying that. They haven't done anything about it up to this point. But that's something we're going to be keeping a lot closer eye on, because a lot of pieces are starting to move, and we'll see what happens overnight. We'll definitely be talking in the morning, give you an update of whatever may transmit overnight. But for example, Dmitry Medvedev has said, listen, if we strike targets outside of Russia and if we hit other kinds of things, even inside of Ukraine, it could potentially expand the war. He acknowledges that. But he says, like some others we've talked about recently, he's implying that it could be a greater sin not to do so because it will invite more attacks. And so he says, yeah, we should just keep going and hit even more. So it's possible that there could be some even bigger strikes coming up. And the fact that Russia has used Oreshnik missiles on a couple of occasions here recently tells you how important these things are and how high they put a priority in those, because they don't have that many Oreshnik missiles. They've only started production for, I think, 8 or 9 months, something like that we know of anyway. So they probably don't have that many of them, because that's a very sophisticated missile system, and they haven't been doing it very long. So they probably don't have many. And the fact that they've used some now implies that they put some really high priority on some of these. So we'll see how a lot of that's going to work out there, because you would think they would want to reserve those for potential use if they get into a clash with NATO, because then those can reach out and do a lot from a long ways away when they have other missile systems they could use for the local. But they haven't, so that means it's really high priority for them. Whatever they fired at, whatever these missile concerns and factories that they fired at, they really do want them knocked out. So we'll take a look at that, because if we just keep on muddling along like this, then we'll have, I think John Mearsheimer calls it a frozen conflict, meaning that it's a conflict, it's just not going anywhere. And that's part of the frustration by some in Russia. They're saying, look, this is we're not going to finish this anytime in the next year or two at this rate. And who wants to just fight a forever war where there's whatever the Russian casualty figures actually are, they'll maintain that. And nobody wants this just perpetual loss of manpower, and it doesn't change on the battlefield. So we'll see what that's going to do. But there's some things to be paying attention here, because this thing could be blowing up right about the same time that we see stuff going on in the Iran war. And God help us if these things blow up simultaneously. This could be a really, really challenging time for the cause of peace around much of the world, certainly the Western world. We're going to keep an eye on this. Thank you very much, folks. We appreciate you today. We got a good lineup of a lot of folks coming up later in the week. Gary, what do we have tomorrow? I didn't see the lineup. What do we have tomorrow?
Oh, yeah, give me a second. Let's see. Give me a second.
Sorry, there's another curveball of Gary right there.
Anyway, Danny, I think we've got Professor Morandi tomorrow, and we definitely have Scott Ritter.
Okay.
Well, we'll dare we tell him that Colonel Douglas will be back.
Yeah. Very good. That's always one of the popular ones here. But with Scott talking about, because if anything happens overnight, there's nobody more connected to that than Scott Ritter and Professor Morandi. Nobody better on the Iranian side about what may or may not be going on over there. So don't miss either one of those shows tomorrow. Great stuff coming through the rest of the week as well. As always, if anything happens, come right here. Gary and I will have it for you on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.
Indeed.
Don't forget to tell your friends, the ones that love to listen to podcasts. Get them to add Daniel Davis Deep Dive to their podcast list. They need to know what you know. They can get it to where they already get their podcast. You just got to tell them.